shining and rippling like waves on the sea. We built the steam engines to sail that wide prairie and charted our course with a lifeline of steel.
I love that song by Lisa Johnson. It's from her CD, This Season. Lisa, of course, a Dane County UW Extension horticulture specialist. And you can buy one on CD Baby. I think you can buy a copy of it. But it's a great way to get into this program, thinking about prairies. And when sometimes you think about the vast prairies that she is singing about there, there are not as many as there used to be, but you know what? There are a lot of places where they have been captured. One place is the University of Wisconsin Arboretum, and there are many other arboretums as well and botanical gardens in your area, and you can get a lot of really great information, learn a lot, and just enjoy the beauty of the arboretums that you have in your area. In Madison, we have the UW-Madison Arboretum, and with us today for Garden Talk is Susan Carpenter. She's the Senior Outreach Specialist in the Wisconsin Native Plant Garden at the UW-Madison Arboretum. And you know what? You don't have to have a huge 100 acres. You can do things in small spaces, as you're going to hear from Susan as we talk with her. We'll talk native plants, how to get involved with the Arboretum, perhaps, and, of course, take your native gardening questions. So join in. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Susan Carpenter, welcome back.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Pretty song, isn't it? It kind of takes
gorgeous.
You back to the
gorgeous
the days of the prairies, and that's been captured, a lot of that, at the UW Arboretum.
Well, like, there's different ways to capture the beauty. So we do have a lot of restored. We do have a lot of acreage, I'd say, relatively being in the middle of Madison. We have quite a few acres of prairie restored there, the Curtis Prairie, of course, the Green mm-hmm. Prairie, which are more historical restorations. There's remnant prairies. And also are some of our restorations that are in savanna areas, more a few trees, but still a lot of prairie plants to be seen. So a lot of active restoration work going on.
And the Arboretum's been around for quite a while. I'm not sure when it started.
Well, but the dedication was 1934, so we like to kind of use that as as a marker. But the idea began a little before that, of course, and the support to get the place underway. But it's just a constant, constant contributions of people, including volunteers and community members and our staff, of course, to bring about the changes that we want to see and the healthy land that we want to maintain.
And we have arboretums around in the state, other arboretums as
true.
Well.
There are lots of different kinds of areas, really, and each one is totally unique. But so there's really something for everyone as you travel around the state. But it can be very interesting to see areas that aren't just exactly like the area that you're used to, but it's good to use local areas for the inspiration if you're using native plants, because native plants, of course, are of a region. So southern Wisconsin, there's a certain set of plants that would work well for your gardening there, and northern Wisconsin kind of, a few different types
plants
of things.
Plants that would work well.
Yeah, with a different climate, different soils, different
And we can
conditions.
Certainly talk about all those as we go along.
I think we probably will.
I think we will. I give you a chance to join in as you listen in. Maybe a question about native plants. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. The polar vortex has come up a lot on Garden Talk over the past, and I'm wondering about its potential effect let's say, the UW Arboretum. Were those native plants affected?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, and I've gotten that question a lot too. I think for the native plants, we would want to look at a little bit bigger picture than just the polar vortex. I did not notice very much damage that I could attribute to the polar vortex in terms of damage to the plants. The native plants have, are relatively well adapted to conditions, even conditions that seem quite extreme. Some of our, I know from our horticultural collection, there was a fair amount of damage because some of those plants are more marginal in our climate.
Sure.
So that was sort of a different topic. But the native plants, one of the reason I was talking about the bigger picture is that we have on average had warmer winters, which means that we have less snow cover and less snow cover at times when it could get very cold. And so ironically, the warmer times without that snow cover make the colder
worse
incidents, yeah, the colder periods even more severe because there's not that tempering or that insulating effect of a snowpack that we would have, that we would have had in years past. So those kind of that fluctuation is more what we would pay attention to. And so it could affect things that you don't see directly in terms of the plants. It could be affecting overwintering insects. It could be affecting, more soil moisture could be affecting, of rains in the winter or, saturated soils that are frozen in the winter might affect, other organisms that are a part of these systems.
And then we had the rain, and the spring was a rainy spring.
Very cool, rainy spring. And I think that did delay some of the blooming and some of the growth of the plants, of course. It had a pretty large effect on the bumblebees because they come out early in the spring. They nest underground, so those big rains with the floods and so forth, I think did we did see an effect of that because we saw less diversity of the bees, lower abundance of the bees, and that's something that we've been monitoring, for some years, so we can sort of see a pattern to that. Last year was also a cold, wet spring.
Yes.
So this year was even colder and wetter. So those 2 years in a row of that do have an impact as well.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Melanie in Oliva has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Melanie.
Hi there. Well, we have 10 acres, and just a couple acres we were getting overgrown with the infamous buckthorn. So I've been fighting this war for years now. And what we did was we had some guy come out, and he just plowed it down, kind of took up a lot of it from the roots. Mm-hmm. But obviously some of it's coming back. I have thrown a few native plants in there because I couldn't wait. But I know it's going to be an ongoing deal. How do I prepare that spot? For grasses are coming back. I don't want to really till it up anymore. It's a big acre, so I can't just cover it. I've got other natives around here that I've covered it and put in natives and stuff. But how do I go about doing that so I can get some native flowers in there and have it just kind of come back as a field?
Yeah, that's a great question, Melanie. I guess I'd be curious. Sometimes what we find when we have an area that has been overgrown with buckthorn for, some time, maybe a couple decades even, and we clear the buckthorn without just, kind of with a forestry mower or just cutting it and treating the stumps, we find that a lot of vegetation that was there just suspended, kind of dormant in the soil. These are plants that come up and kind of recover or rebound from that clearing. So once the light's back on the ground again, those plants respond. And it's pretty surprising at times with wetland plants, prairie plants, and so on. If the area didn't have a history like that, in other words, it was, had some other use or maybe very, very heavy grazing or I don't know what your area was before it was, before the buckthorn grew in, but then you might want to supplement. So the important thing to think about there is it just wide open? Do you want to, if it is wide open, then maybe some seed mixes would be appropriate there for, open areas. If it's got semi-shade, then seed mixes that have to do with that. And you might just start with, you're going to be doing some retreating and keeping after the buckthorn again. Birds may bring more seeds through.
Yeah, for sure.
Nearby plants may. So you do want to kind of see what it's going to become now that it's not so shady. If it's wide open, then go with more of a prairie mix. And if it's semi-shaded, more of a savanna type set of plants.
Yeah. Yeah. What's the soil like there?
We are up on a hill. The part I'm talking about is a little lower, but it does kind of have shale, kind of dry soil.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the other half of the field is all goldenrod, and I happen to have beehives on my land here, mm-hmm. so they're going crazy on those. But I would just like to kind of continue yeah. with, you know, the grasses and the... And wow. I'm already getting milkweed and stuff coming up, but mm-hmm. I just want to throw in a few flowers, some mm-hmm. more.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would add, you could add seeds there as long as you're keeping after the resprouts of the buckthorn and keeping it open, you should get good response with that. And your instinct about not tilling it more is probably a good idea because that does tend to just bring out more weed seeds that yeah. are coming along. So,
well, good luck, Melanie.
Let
us, yeah, let us know next year how it goes.
Yeah, thanks
thank
for working on that.
Oh, man. Let's go to Kurt in Brownsville. Hi, Kurt.
Yes. About a year ago, we were victims of the tornadoes that came through the area, and we lost a bunch of our trees. So we are replanting, or actually just transplanting some smaller pine trees and firs, I just wondered if there's anything, they're only about 2 to 3 feet tall, and I was just wondering if there's anything I need to do to protect them from the wind or anything or the snow, you know, this winter, or will they be all right just leaving them out there?
Okay, I think probably, is the area very exposed to wind or?
Yeah, we've got the generally. Wind towers right around us, so we're the windiest spot in the state.
Ah, okay, that's interesting. Well, I mean, one of the first things, just with the trees themselves, as you plant them, this is a good time to plant because the soils will remain warm enough for the next, 6 weeks. Two months to really grow the roots. And this is a time of year when roots do grow. So it is a good time for the planting. You want to make sure that it's kept moist. We're in kind of a dry period right now. So you want to make sure that the roots are getting enough moisture. Kind of a rule of thumb with that is if you don't get an inch of rain per week, you want to supplement water it. And whether that's practical in your situation, I don't know. But you might also mulch around them, the small trees, in order to keep that soil moisture even, just to not let those roots dry out as they're, you don't want to overwater them, but you want to keep it, you know, moist enough so that those roots can kind of get the signal to grow and establish before it gets too cold.
And I was just going to add to that, a lot of times people sort of, once it gets to be October, if it, you know, you people tend not to water anymore, the hoses go away or whatever, you know, it gets stored and stuff, and you probably should do it right up.
Well, it kind of depends on your temperature, on the temperatures and how dry it really is, because a lot of times later in the fall, we'll get more rains steadily.
Right.
So it just depends on how our patterns. You don't have to water them during the winter because there won't be, you know, once the soils have cooled, then the roots will just be where they are until next year.
Spring. Yeah. Mm. There you go, Kurt. Thank you so much for calling. Shirley and Nakusa, we'll go to you next. Hi.
Hi there. Yeah, I'll get going and maybe give me some help. I got a hill that of me took some, we did a parking lot and we got extra dirt and it's mostly sand and we made a hill out of it and now we made a waterfall. And it's quite high, and we put stone all the way around the outside of it. Mm-hmm. And now I want to know if somebody could help me with what kind of amount of perennials in there, in amongst there. And
boy, native
perennials, and there's some nice shade there.
Okay, is the soil where the plants will be growing? Is it wet or is it sandy?
Sandy.
But
what I do is put some, dig out the hole big enough and put some compost in there. Take that sand out.
Yeah. Well, you could go with plants that do well on sandy, dry soils. And I find with our sand garden at the Arboretum that it's it tends to be fairly weed-free because the weeds can't mm-hmm. do as well on that soil as they do in regular garden soil. It's also awfully fun to pull weeds out of sand because they come up popping
come right
out of the ground. But so what you might look for are plants that are adapted to a dry site. you said it's semi-shady, but does it get, how much full sun does it, how much sun does it get?
In the morning, mostly.
Okay,
morning sun.
All right, so this is a challenging situation. I think you would want to, you might want to look into savanna or plants that are suited to a barrens situation. Now, barrens is just a term for, like we have pine barrens and sand barrens. So where you do have some shade, but it's basically still a very well-drained soil as you're talking about. So Nakusa?
It's a sandy area.
It's a sandy area, yeah. I would take inspiration from, you might check some of the seed catalogs and native plant sources for plants that will work in well-drained soils, and so they don't need they're just in dry or very, very, you know, mostly dry soils that can take a little bit of shade. So sand, not sand prairie plants so much, but like a savanna type species.
And there are, Prairie Nursery is one, has a great website.
Yeah, and sometimes they put mixes together that list a whole list of species that go together in that kind of situation. So look for those characteristics, dry soil, semi-shade, and look for the intersection of that for your space and area, the number of plants that you need.
There you go.
You don't think that compost would be a good thing up in there, huh?
Well, the compost will just tend, compost would just tend to keep the, you know, you could maybe plant a plant there for a little while, but the compost is only going to be in a certain spot. And so the roots wouldn't go, you know, you might find a mismatch and the plants wouldn't really be, it'd be like setting pots into the area. So you might be better off going with plants that can really adapt to that well-drained soil.
I would agree with that for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So good luck, Shirley. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Susan Carpenter, Senior Outreach Specialist at the UW-Madison Arboretum. Our guest today, Dave Potras, our engineer, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at native plants and prairies here on the Ideas Network. Susan Carpenter, our guest from the UW-Madison Arboretum. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Questions, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And you can also send some photos as well. We've got one, and we'll talk about that in a minute. A nice one from Dan in Eau Claire. But first, let's go to Harold in Burnham Wood. Harold, hello.
Good morning.
Morning.
I tuned in a little bit late, but I, as usual, this program turns into one of those dirty words, which in this case was buckthorn.
Yeah.
And I missed the beginning of the caller as to what was all done, but it sounded like the soil was perhaps plowed some and or a brush cutter maybe cut it off. And all I know about the buckthorn in my experience is I know chemicals are also a dirty word, and especially if you have to spray them. But there's two different ones I've used, and I can't remember what they are. One you can put on the cut stump, and it must be put on in less than an hour after cutting, and the other you can brush on the bark, which doesn't aerate in terms of getting to place where bees are going to be. But from what I could visualize that field, from my experience with buckthorn, it will turn into a beautiful sea of gorgeous green leaves and shrubs. Every plant will send up, I think, 10 or more. Every piece of root will send up stuff that's disturbed. It puts quackgrass to shame and far of its ability to continue. But
yeah.
I think that has to be brought up on almost any time it gets mentioned. It just can't get rid of it by cutting. It just sends up multiple shoots.
Yeah.
That was a great point, and I think the caller is probably going to be, it sounds like she's really on top of her situation and has been working on it successfully for quite some time. But you're right, it's a survivor and a very prolific resprouter.
Yeah, that's for sure. Thanks, Harold. Appreciate it. Well, Judy and Ripon, as long as we're on buckthorn, I think has something relating to it. Let's go there. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I think you might have just answered my question when I was caught in the process of my calling. What is it that you're treating the buckthorn with? I would love to know, because I've got a few sprouting right now that I'd like to get rid of.
Well, if you if the scale of the buckthorn is small, then repeated cutting will be effective. And by small, I mean
pencil size.
Very, very small. I mean, you do have to keep after it. So if you're it's not the kind of thing where you can just say, I'm going to cut it all down and then I'm done with it. I'm on to phase two. You really do need, you know, all these things that all these areas that we're caring for, these plants, animals and so forth. We have an ongoing relationship with them. As far as what you can treat them with, there are herbicides that you can use on the cut stumps. So so Garlon is one of them that is used, and it's very carefully just put on that cut stump, as the previous caller just mentioned, right on the, right after it's cut, preferably. And then that goes down into the root system and helps keep things under control. One thing, though, an area that has a lot of buckthorn often has a lot of buckthorn seed in the soil, too. So you will see new germinating plants coming up, the little seedlings. You learn to recognize those. And so it can be an ongoing process. But Garlon is an effective one. You can, I'm sure if you are looking up, if you use your browser to look up buckthorn and, control and treatment, you'll find the concentrations and so forth that you would use for that. So, you could start pretty conservatively with it. If you have a small area especially, you might not need to go to that extent. If you have very small plants, you could probably get them out without cutting. You can just pull them out. Depending on your soils, we pull out a lot of them just like you pull out weeds, and then you're done with them for good right there.
Yeah, there you go.
It depends on your situation, whether they're giant trees or... And if they are giant, what you might look for is buckthorn has male and female trees. So if you have a female tree in your area, that would be the first one to cut down. It's going to have dark berries on it at this time of year, falling off and producing the seeds. The male trees can't produce seeds. So you can see why I would say prioritize getting rid of the female trees first.
All right. And the males don't have the berries.
They don't have berries. They do participate in the pollination,
right?
But the important thing is there's male and female trees are separate individuals. So
get rid of the female trees first
to reduce the seed input, and then you can go after the male trees because they're also shading, of course, putting out
right.
They're
suppressing
other plants.
There you go, Judy. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call, Alan in Portage. I'm to you now. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I was just asking about American chestnut trees, if there's any in the state growing around. I have some land in Illinois I'd like to start some on.
There are some.
Yeah, that's a great question. American chestnut, of course, people may not be aware, was a fairly common tree throughout the East, and it was affected by chestnut blight, and that really eliminated it from a lot of areas. But there is a population, as I understand it, in near the La Crosse area. But if you're looking for something closer to Portage, we have in our horticultural garden at the Arboretum three very large mature trees. American chestnuts, and they're in the right there near the visitor center, the horticultural garden, Longenecker Gardens, near the visitor center, and they are just beautiful mature trees.
Gorgeous.
So I do recommend you come and see those. They would be producing their very spiny nut. The husks of the nuts are very spiny, and those are produced at this time of year. You'll see those now. It blooms in the very early part of July, usually. So it's worth coming to see it during the bloom time, too. But those are the ones that I would visit. They're about spectacular.
Yeah. Actually, American chestnuts weren't native to Wisconsin, were they? I don't think they were.
I think we were. I hope I'm correct in saying this. I think that we are at the edge of their range, the western edge of their range. So And that actually is one reason why when isolated populations are present, disease cannot spread as easily through them as in a more dense area. So that's one reason why isolated populations can sometimes persist when a disease is present in that species in other areas.
And I just did a quick typing here on my my phone,
yeah,
and put American chestnut trees in Wisconsin in, and up popped a picture of the state of Wisconsin with the counties where they're present.
But, excellent.
But those at the UW Arboretum are absolutely gorgeous trees, man. Mm-hmm. They're worth seeing, Alan. Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Tom in Rhinelander next. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi, Tom.
I'm calling by phone. I was just curious. I didn't know I was the right Tom.
Oh, sorry. I didn't say Tom in Rhinelander, did I? Sorry.
That's correct. And I am in Rhinelander. I have a question for your guest. Your guest is the first person I've ever heard articulate the fact that these recent terrible winters we have were made worse by the fact that we would have very low snow cover and then a cold snap that would kill things. I have rose bushes, English roses. I have rhododendrons, azaleas in both Chicago and Rhinelander, and I know your guest is not a gardener, so to speak, but although I normally wrap my rhododendrons with burlap just to keep the protect them from the winter wind, what is there any easy way to protect? I have about 15 plants in various places that have been seriously damaged by the last couple of winters. To protect all of them with burlap and some kind of insulation would be quite a job. Is there any other way that I can deal with this, or am I looking at the fact that a couple of more bad winters and I won't have these plants?
Wow, that's a great question. I wouldn't ever claim to be an expert on the English roses or other types of that. At the Arboretum, we have between both of our gardens, for example, the native plant garden, I have native roses. And for those, we do nothing, but they're not a large, you know, showy rose. They're not really, you wouldn't mistake them for an ornamental rose. They have the very simple flowers and they're, you know, spread throughout the prairie plants. We also have at the Arboretum a large collection of rugosa roses, and those are in the horticultural collection or in some of our more ornamental plantings. And those we have because they're the only roses, as I understand it, that the deer won't eat. So our problem at the Arboretum is not so much the weather, I don't think, and protection as you're talking about, Tom, but the fact that we have so many deer eating plants at any time of year that if we don't screen them or, you know, fence them, we would lose them. So I don't have a lot of experience with having to protect them. I mean, I know just from my own casual observations that people will put cones over them and put leaves around and put cones over and sort of that insulating idea for their garden roses. But
yeah, and the rugosa rose, you got a place in Rhinelander, Tom. So
yeah,
you might want to think about rugosa roses for that particular spot that you've got. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Kirk in Chippewa Falls. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, last spring I planted quite a few spruce of different varieties, and I did not mulch them. I let the weeds grow up 2, 3, 4 feet tall around them under the theory that it would protect them from the hot summer sun. Now I'm wondering if I should leave those weeds there or not to protect them from winter wind burn. What's your advice?
Well, I think that if you have, I think that the plants that the weeds that you're talking about that are around the trees, are those grasses and just herbaceous plants
Stemmy weeds, long stem weeds, some grassy stuff.
Okay. So I mean, I think if you keep having those plants both in the growing season and in the winter, I mean, yeah, in the growing season especially, if you keep having those plants around your saplings, it may interfere with the saplings, you know, photosynthesis and so forth. If it's just for protection while they're getting, you know, while they were transitioning in their first, you know, few months, I don't think there's any harm in leaving it for the winter. But as a regular practice, it might harm them from developing, you know, like next year, if you let them grow up again and then they're still, they're, that's going to start hampering their growth, I think, if they're covered up.
They're going
to
compete with the
tree. They'll be competing with the trees. So I think maybe leave them there this winter and then start next season, start clearing around them so that they can, so that the saplings can get more light, and maybe that material could just be left around on the ground, you know, cut and left around on the ground, mowed down around them, maybe, if that's practical. It's hard to know without seeing your situation.
There you go, Kirk. Thank you. Jill in Racine, on to you now. Hi, Jill.
Oh, hi. I just went outside to measure my pine. I have a pine that I don't know how it grew, but it's about 12, 14 inches tall. And we moved, so I put it in a big pot. Now I want to know how and when to transplant that so it survives.
Okay, what kind of pine is it?
I'm not really sure.
Okay. Well, I think that the general advice, as we were talking earlier with someone about pines, about planting, is this would probably be a good time to plant it. It seems like 12 to 14 inches is getting pretty tall for it being in a pot, because remember that the root system of a plant is more developed than the top part. And so the root is the first part to go down out of the seed, and the part that's above the ground is, you know, second. So I think you might want to go ahead and plant it this fall, plant it now. And again, keep, you know, if we're in a dry period, keep the soil moist around it by giving it a little water if there's no rain. Like, the rule of thumb is an inch of rain per week. If it's a tiny little plant like that, you would only need really to moisten right around it. Select a good place that, if you can figure out what kind of pine it is, a good location for that type. If it needs moist, you know, medium soil or maybe drier soil, depending on what kind it is. And then mulch around it, just this to make sure that the soil moisture is kept even for as it established. And then next spring, when we come out of the winter, keep an eye on it for watering in its first year, because if it would go into a drought next year, then you'd want to be, for the first year of its establishment, you'd really want to be keeping up with that rule of thumb about water.
And thank you very much for calling, Jill. Appreciate it. Mike in Oshkosh, on to you. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Tuned in a little late, but I have a question regarding birch trees. I had a clump of birch in front of my house for about 35 years, and most of the rest of them in the neighborhood died out, but I managed to keep it alive. But now it's dead. There is a type of birch tree that I've seen while hunting morels to the southwest of the Madison area. And it has a very shaggy bark on it, and it seemed to be doing very well there. And I thought this might be something I'd want to plant now to replace the dead one. And I'm wondering if I should have the stump ground out or just let it rot.
Hmm. So you're planning to, do you think it's the same species? The one you're going to replace it is the same species as the one that you lost?
No.
Oh.
The one that I lost was a very smooth white bark. The one that I saw near Madison was more of a shaggy bark, and I'm pretty sure it's a birch cultivar, because my sister had this exact, had the shaggy one in Shawnee, and it was a very attractive birch tree.
So is, I think the shaggy one may be, is it a river birch perhaps? Was it in a wetter area? Because there's the white birch, which is the smooth one you described. But then the river birch has a little rougher It's still a birch, but it's a rougher bark to it.
That is possible. As I said, Sean was a very sandy area. It wasn't a moist area at all, but they took care of it. And when I was hunting morels, I don't recall it being in a particularly moist area. Mm-hmm. But that's where I ran across this big grove of them.
Hmm. Well, as far as your question about grinding the stump and replacing it, I think that just depends on how if you can learn a little bit more about get some photos of those trees that you're interested in and really nail down what they are, they might need a different location than the one that you had for so long. So you might look at whether that particular spot is suitable. Another thing sometimes is with trees, with tree disease, if a tree has died in an area and the disease is present there, then you maybe not want to go back to that same spot with the same type of tree, even if it's a little bit different, species of the same genus. So a lot of unknowns in this question. I think one of the main things to do would be find out maybe next year when you're looking for your morels, is see if you can identify that, get some more information to identify that tree that you're interested in, and then go from there.
Yeah, you could look up river birch online and just get some photos, and you'll quickly be able to tell if it's what you saw, I think.
I think so, too.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Going to our emails, Dan sent a photo of his front yard in Eau Claire with some native plants. He started it from seed 7 years ago. He says he has dozens of different butterflies and birds, and he still has monarchs. And that's
wow, this is great. Yeah, so this picture is spectacular. Just you could see the house with the garden about 3 feet tall and in front of it with lots and lots of flowers. So started from seed 7 years ago, so that shows that you can really come up with a beautiful planting in not all that much time. He didn't talk about whether it was difficult to do or not, so I'm assuming that it was a great process. So the important thing about a garden like this with lots and lots of flowers is you do get a lot of pollinators and other wildlife there. And one thing would be neat for someone in Dan's situation to do, since he has monarchs attracted to his garden and possibly even some hummingbirds. Hummingbirds will use some of the flowers that he has shown here. And we have a project at the Arboretum now, a new citizen science project that anyone from anywhere in North America or Mexico or Canada can participate in, and it's called Journey North. And so if you have monarchs, especially this time of year, and hummingbirds, they're migrating. They're in their migrating period. And this project allows you to take pictures of them in your garden or wherever you are, park or natural area, and then then submit those photos and your observations to journeynorth.org. And then the picture of what is going on with the migration emerges from all these records. And there's
That's really cool.
thousands of people participating. So join in the fun. It will track the migration of the monarchs down through Wisconsin and down through to Mexico. And the hummingbirds are traveling not right side by side with them maybe, but they're also traveling. So we get a lot of information about those large-scale migration patterns from just people submitting their observations from all over. It's wonderful. So journeynorth.org is the website, and you can link to that either directly or through the Arboretum website, which is arboretum.wisc.edu.
And I was saying, as you were talking, I was thinking about the folks over at Goose Pond, the natural area there. They last week on Friday said they had something like 800 monarchs.
Yes. Wonderful.
All there at one time.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's a congregation of them, that a roosting place, and then after sometimes it happens every year in the same place, but sometimes it's more intermittent like that. And then I bet they tagged some of those 800, didn't they?
I bet they did. Yeah. Well, Susan Carpenter, our guest today, we're talking with her about the UW-Madison Arboretum. We're talking native plants, prairie plants with her. I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234 or email us your photos or questions to ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at native plantings today on the Ideas Network for this edition of Garden Talk, I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Susan Carpenter, our guest today, Senior Outreach Specialist for the UW-Madison Arboretum. Always fun to have her with us. Questions for her, give a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Marie in Jefferson has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Marie.
Hi. I'm wondering, we have sumac here, both the poison kind and one that isn't, and it seems like the one that isn't poisonous seems to just be taking over around our house and our property. My husband has said that crossbow is good for what he uses on the poison sumac. Is that a good thing to use for the other kind that are not poisonous?
I don't know for sure what the best option is for or the best use for crossbow on that, but I think that the way that I've learned that sumac can be best controlled, and you're looking to get rid of it completely, or I mean to minimize it completely, or are you just looking to reduce its size reduce its?
Yeah, both. I mean, we've got some that are quite tall, and in the past I've used a Bayer Advanced, a brush killer plus, and that's mm-hmm. supposed to kill brush roots and all, and also ivy, poison ivy, and so forth. But I don't know if this is really effective as much as the crossbow. We have kind of an argument between the two of us about which is the better thing.
Well, I think with the sumac, one thing people sometimes do is they wait until winter to cut it down, and actually cutting it down in the winter, in my understanding, actually amplifies it. So it's better to cut it in the growing season, and we're kind of peeking past that by now, but cut it in the growing season. I would think that spot treatment might help with that too, as we were talking about before, but it is important to remember that sumac is a clonal species, so you to us it kind of looks like a bunch of trees, but to the sumac it's really an area that they've got, that it's got covered with a root system that's very prevalent. I think that it would probably be if you're concerned about the use of the chemicals or an excessive use or whatever, it's a good idea to find out what's the least you can use to do the job effectively. And I'm afraid I might not be the best person for that. If you'd like to send in that question to the info at email address, that could be referred to our land care manager, and he could probably give you some insight. They do a lot of cut and treat with sumac, so with smooth sumac, so he would have some better advice for you than I would.
So UW-Madison Arboretum?
Yeah, it's info@arboretum.wisc.edu.
All right.
Yeah.
There we go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. We have Roseanne emailed some suggestions for plants that will do well in dry, sandy soil. Remember earlier?
Yep, she's got some great ideas there. She suggests to the person who's interested in growing in dry, sandy soil with some partial shade, lupin, the wild lupin. This would be the native lupin perennis, not the garden lupin. That can be a problem. Coreopsis, the wild columbine, the flowering spurge, the dotted mint, the goat's rue, elm leaf goldenrod, which is blooming right now, the whorled loosestrife, little blue stem, purple lovegrass, and the anise hyssop. And a lot of those have a lot of value, wildlife value, as well as being good relatively short plants for that kind of situation. I don't know if that list can be put up on...
Maybe we can post that.
Post it.
Maybe Jill can post that list for us. on our WPR.org site.
Nice suggestions.
Yeah, they're really good suggestions. Thank you for that. Let's go to Kent, or Carrie, excuse me, in Ottawa. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We planted an area of prairie last year. We covered it with cardboard for the whole season, the whole summer. And then we cast our seed right before winter.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've got mostly is a big field of Queen Anne's lace.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And the reason for that is because the soil had, obviously, has seeds of Queen Anne's lace from, you know, past years. And Queen Anne's lace is in the carrot family, and it's a biennial. So that means that if a seed germinates in 1 year, it grows into a little tiny plant just on the ground, a little tiny rosette. And then the second year, it sends up that familiar stalk with the white flowers. And then those little tiny flowers that are on a like a branched circular format, that when they start curling up, that's when the seeds are starting to mature and spread as well. So how big is your area, Carrie?
It's, I don't know, like 200 feet by 200 feet.
Okay. It's always a good idea with a biennial that you don't want to have more of to at least get rid of the seed heads. Usually, now, are your other prairie plant, you grew them from seed, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So usually the practice for planting a new planting with seed is to keep it mowed about a foot tall, 10 inches to a foot tall, the first couple of years. And the reason there is that if you mow that, then to that height, the prairie plants are growing more slowly, getting their roots established, and they're getting started. The weeds, like the Queen Anne's lace, just shot up, and you would have topped off the seed heads from it prevented its flowering. So what I'd suggest is, is it still blooming at all?
We're debating, should we pull it or should we just try and like somehow pull off the heads?
I would go with pulling off the heads at this point, because if you disturb the soil, then all the rest of the Queen Anne's lace seeds that are there will get a good start for the next cycle. You're going to have Queen Anne's lace for a while, but it will get less as your prairie plants become more strong and more, you know, more present in the area. So I would suggest the mowing next year, and by that I mean really high mowing of that area, and see if you can keep it from producing even more seeds. And it won't harm your prairie plants because they're still pretty short.
Yeah, and if you don't have a mower that'll go that high, you could probably do it with a weed whacker.
Yeah, weed whacker. Weed whackers could be used very well for that.
Yeah, for sure.
It might be in patches, so you wouldn't even have to
do the whole thing.
Yeah, you could just go after the worst of it.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Carrie. Appreciate your call. Sherry in Wilton, hi.
Hi, we have a pond, and we would like to plant wildflowers all around the pond, but they need to be low maintenance.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that sounds like they usually will be fairly low maintenance. The trick is sometimes, as we just heard, getting the thing started. I don't know how large of an area are you talking about? A band of vegetation around your pond?
Yeah, probably 8 to 10 feet deep around the perimeter of the pond.
Okay. Well, you might look for, one problem is you don't want erosion into the pond, I'm sure. So you don't want to be digging, you know, tilling it up or anything like that. You may want to start a little bit away from the, you know, just leave a little border of whatever's there now. Is it grass?
Nope.
Uh-oh.
I think she said yes.
Yes. Okay. So you may want to, you would definitely want a mix for wet mesic, meaning medium to wet soils. And again, I would suggest some of your native plant nurseries to give you to provide that kind of list within a seed mix. So you wouldn't necessarily have to do it with seeds, but you could do it with plants scattered around, and the plants would spread themselves as well, or do it with seeds. And you'd have to prepare the soil for that. So it can be tricky. You just want to avoid the erosion into the pond, I'm sure. But match the plants to the situation there, which will be wet, plants that like wet habitat or wet mesic habitat. And these mixes will tell you the list of species, and you can pick and choose a little bit for the plants that you want to use.
Susan Carpenter, our guest today. She is the Senior Outreach Specialist in the Wisconsin Native Plant Garden at the UW-Madison Arboretum. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at prairies, prairie plants, the UW Arboretum on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest Susan Carpenter, a senior outreach specialist for the UW-Madison Arboretum. It's great to have her back as we talk native planting, so we'll talk a bit more about the Arboretum as well with her. Questions for her, join in at 800-642-1234. Or you can email us your questions and photos, if you like, at ideas@wpr.org. And Linda in Plymouth has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Linda.
Hi. There is a plant that I love beyond all other fall plants. I always call it the wild Joe weed, but it's got the big purple plumes on it, and it grows about 6 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
I love that plant.
Joe Pieweed?
This year, Joe Pieweed, that's what it's called. Mm-hmm. It is alive, I mean literally alive, with 3-4 different types of butterflies, moths, bees. It is just amazing to watch, and it's so beautiful.
Well, Linda, I can't add much to that description. You've hit the nail on the head. It's a wonderful plant if you have a lot of space, or like for an accent if you're in a smaller garden. It seeds itself well, and there's two species that are pretty common around our area. So one of them is a little more suitable for wetter areas. So it really does a great job of filling in. And one of the reasons it's so great for pollinators, as you observed, is that it blooms at a time when we're kind of in between the summer blooming species and the more late summer blooming species. And it can grow in sun, it can grow in shade. So you are absolutely right. And thanks for bringing that to everyone's attention.
Lots of pollinators. Thanks, Linda. Appreciate it. There's another plant that we got a photo of from Kim that is not such a nice plant.
Well, this one is the picture shows a very mature, it's called the pokeweed. And it's a very mature plant of it. So this can be a very large plant. It can be, I whacked down one in our service area at the Arboretum the last week, which was about 6 feet tall and 6 feet in diameter with branching. The reason that I did cut it down is that, as this picture shows, it has very attractive looking purple berries, and each stalk of berries is about 6 inches long, and there are many of them over the plant. As those berries mature, they turn a dark purple, and people often think that they would be a good berry to eat or make jam? And the answer to that is absolutely not. So pokeweed has, the plant is poisonous, and it's not a good idea to think about eating those berries. So again, it's really important to know what's edible and what isn't edible.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So this one I do tend, especially in areas where it would be, where children would be near it or kind of tempted to try those berries, I do cut and remove those. There is a native species and there is a non-native species. They both are similar in their looks. They're similar in being poisonous, and they are ecologically they're pretty similar. So I do
get rid of them.
I do eliminate them. Yeah, and one of my colleagues just sent me a picture of a very small one. It's kind of doing a late bloomer, I guess we could call it, because the flowers of them are white on a little cluster. So when you see the flowers, you might not recognize that it's going to become this long stalk of purple berries.
Helen in Menominee Falls, it's your turn now. Hi, Helen.
Hi. I'm calling to ask, what is the proper way to prepare seeds from the milkweed plant for planting at this time of year? The area I'm thinking of is never fertilized and never has bugs on spray on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very natural.
Mm-hmm.
But full of a lot of wild plants.
Right. So the important thing about getting the seeds, planting the seeds of the milkweed there, first of all, do you have the seeds when you harvest them from the milkweed, or obviously if you purchase them, they're already separated, but when you harvest them from the pods, you can separate them, as you get them out of the pods, you can separate them right away from the fluffy part of the pod, just by splitting it open, holding the fluffy part and scraping the brown seeds away. You want to make sure they're mature, so they'll be kind of a chestnut brown color when they're ready and kind of filled out. They're a flat seed, but they're kind of filled. You know, you can tell that they have something to them. And so once you've got those seeds, you want to keep them in a paper bag, because you don't want to have moisture collecting around them as you would in a plastic bag. So use paper bags and let them just dry a little naturally. That'll be fine. And you can go ahead and plant them the later part of the fall if you just want to get them out on the ground. You do want them to be in contact with soil, though. So if you've got a field that's already growing plants, you do want to kind of go through and get some bare soil for those seeds to get in contact with. And I would just go ahead and plant them in the fall, direct plant them, so you wouldn't have to do anything over the winter with them other than have them already on the ground outside. And then you'll see them germinating next spring, and they'll have gone through the winter, you know, any winter treatment that they might need. And you'll be on your way.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Easy.
How deep to plant them?
You don't have to plant them deep. You don't have to dig them into the ground unless you're doing just kind of a little bit of raking. The main thing is to get them flat on the ground and in contact with the ground. So sometimes people walk around on them, kind of rake a little bit of soil and just get them right on the ground. And and if you do this in like November, the freeze thaw cycle will help bring them into the soil. And that's really all you need to do.
All right. There you go, Helen. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mike in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Or good afternoon. Hey, the timing of this program is excellent. I just discovered today that the big, beautiful plant growing my baby back patio is American pokeweed, and mm-hmm. how dangerous it is. Even to touch. So what I want to know is, how do you get rid of them so they don't come back?
Yeah, this is it's actually pretty easy to get rid of them. I think they usually come into areas as seed because, of course, they would be carried by birds too. If it's a huge plant, I bet it has its stem at the ground is probably like maybe 2 inches across. I just use a lopper and get rid of that. And then you can just take it. It's kind of it grew all this year. It's not like this is not ongoing from, you know, year after year. So it all grew from this year. So it's actually hollow, and the root is a storage root, but you can, if you just have one plant, I would just take a shovel and get in at the edge of it and just break that, you know, break the root a little underground. If it's moist, if you want to water around it and moist enough and see if you can pull that or, you know, dig it that way when the ground is moist, that's another way. But you won't have any trouble with it, you know, being a persistent problem in the future.
There you go. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate the call. We have Michael in Green Bay up next. Hi, Michael. I think we lost Michael. That's fine. You know, there the Arboretum has a lot of events and a lot of things going on, and I did want to make sure we got to that.
Yeah. Well, fall is just a terrific time at the Arboretum. Besides all the natural beauty of the prairie grasses and the fall blooming, and then of course the tree color, October is just also a wonderful busy time for us in terms of events that people can come to. So we have a fall lecture series this year, Indigenous Knowledge Inspired by the Land, and that will be 4 Tuesday evenings in October, where we have lectures and they're at 7 o'clock to 8:30. These lectures are free, no registration required. We would have a suggested donation at the door, but we would welcome people to come to these. We'll have Patty Lowe, Diana Peterson, Omer Poehler, and Michael Dockery he's from Minnesota. So those will be the speakers at the 4 weeks, and it's just going to be a very interesting and wonderful series. We have another opportunity for people who want to get hands-on experience, and that is we have a core of volunteers who lead our weekly ecological restoration work parties, and this goes on all year round. So training for that is coming up in October. This is our team leader training, and we're getting people signing up for that now. The deadline to sign up is September 25th, and there's information about this opportunity on our website. In a nutshell, what it allows people to do is learn a lot about the vegetation, the practices, some of the things we've been talking about today with eliminating mm-hmm. buckthorn and treating buckthorn and sumac and so forth. All that information is included. And then also leadership training and how to work with our groups of wonderful volunteers. So you would work with experienced leaders and our staff to learn how to do all this. And then you get to... put it into practice. And it's a great experience because you not only would be helping at the Arboretum through time, but many of our team leaders go on to work in this field and to contribute in other places. So it's really part of our mission to teach people how to do these things and how to get other people inspired to do them. So those are some of the things that we have coming on.
We have a photo from Joe in Hayward, sent a photo of a tree and wondering what it was.
Oh, that's a great tree. This is a basswood tree. So we have kind of heart-shaped leaves there. They have teeth along the edges, kind of a large open leaf. And then she's also sent a picture of the fruits of this tree. So basswood, for anyone who has one, is familiar with these little helicopter-like modified leaves that have a little ball attached to them. And originally they had a flower cluster, and then one of those flowers develops into a fruit, and that's like a little pea-sized fruit. And those fall then on the yard, and that's the reproductive technique for this plant. So that is a basswood, and it's... it's a wonderful tree, and it has a beautiful fall color. It's a yellow in the fall. It's just
lovely. Yeah, it's
lovely.
A very mm-hmm. lovely tree for yeah. sure. Mm-hmm. Leslie emailed that maybe the listener who called about poison sumac didn't have poison sumac. It's rare in Wisconsin and would only be found in swampy areas, if at all. Mm-hmm. That's correct, isn't it?
Well, there are several kinds of sumac, so it can be confusing. And I'm wondering, I do agree with that. If the earlier caller may have had two types of sumac that were growing, and mm-hmm. so they did look different from each other. The clonal species that we usually see and that we're usually working with in the battling against in the prairies are the smooth sumac and the staghorn sumac, but both of them, again, ecologically kind of work the same.
Ed in West Chicago will give you a chance now. Hi there, Ed. Did we lose Ed? Maybe we lost Ed.
Nope, I'm here.
Oh good.
Okay, there
Hi.
You go. What's on your mind today?
Quick question about a forested area behind my house, deciduous.
Okay.
Starting to get woodland plants established back there, but there's a lot of the stickers and there is some phlox coming in, but mainly a lot of, it seems like, normal forest weeds. And I'm wondering if you have any recommendations of seeds that can be broadcast that will come up fast and compete with some of those sticker plants and the other things that are back there growing.
Yeah, it sounds like you have, I mean, a lot of our deciduous areas, when you mentioned the sticker plants, I know which ones you mean, and they are, I always do like to remind people that they are native plants, although there are a couple of them that I definitely try not to brush past in the fall. However, if you're looking to increase the diversity of your area, one thing to really do is to make sure that you look at it carefully at different times of year and see what things are there with a deciduous area, with what things are there during the time that the where the tree leaves haven't, you know, early in the spring where the tree leaves haven't filled in yet. So what do you have? It'd be interesting to know, do you have spring ephemeral plants in there already that you would have no evidence of seeing now, but would be there present in the spring?
It's moist mesic, and there's bluebells and mayapple that are well established back there, bloodroot, wild ginger.
Yep.
I've moved those back over the few years. I put plants in different areas and they're spreading, but I still have a lot of the kind of the frontier plants that normally grow in that moist mesic. I don't know if some kind of a carex would be good to try and get a ground cover that would compete with the frontier.
Yeah, kind of I think some of those frontier plants or those ones that get travel around well with the sticky seeds and fruits, they'll always be there. But as far as, you know, I think you could look at increasing diversity, and what you're doing is exactly what I'd recommend getting. And it takes a little longer to build out a deciduous planting than it does, under deciduous trees than it does to start a prairie, because you won't necessarily have as fast a growth with it being shadier. As it gets shadier and shadier, if that's happening in your site, then the plants shift. A couple of sedge suggestions you might try. Pennsylvania sedge will work well in semi-shade. It's a small sedge and it'll spread itself if you're patient. And then Sprengel's sedge is another a little bit taller sedge that grows well in shade and semi-shade. So those are both things that would be nice to have there anyway. But I think, you know, continuing to get diversity and getting the woodland plants that grow together, if you've got success with some of them, you might check the flora, this big book called The Flora of the Chicago Region. Look up the plants in your area that are doing well. Just look up those plants in that book and look at which plants grow with them, because it lists the associates of all the species. So if you look up mayapple, it'll give a list of, on a mesic site, mayapple grows with, and it gives the whole list. So you could look to some of those species and use them. So that book is, again, called The Flora of the Chicago Region.
Well, thank you very much. Excellent suggestions.
All right, thanks. Ed. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dan emailed to answer the listener who asked if native gardening was difficult. He said it's not difficult. You just need patience. He had some time, so he had to control the soil. He did it for 3 years before he actually planted the seeds. After removing the sod, he put down a black tarp and then a blue tarp over the top of the black tarp. he pretended it was a little pond. Neighbors thought he was nuts because he planted some cattails and put some duck decoys out there. And during the winter, he put an old-fashioned tip up out there. So he had a lot of fun.
Kind of a creative approach to soil preparation. Yep, very good.
And Michael in Green Bay, I know we lost Michael, but he wondered about planting trees over stumps from the trees that he took down. And there could be some, if the trees weren't diseased or...
Yeah, and if there's enough space for, you know, if the trees were spaced apart and there's just, I mean... Yeah. You've done that. If the stump is not in the way, the root system is still there. But if you could, you know, as long as the stumps aren't really close together, I don't think you would have a problem with that. As long as there wasn't a disease issue.
Yeah, it shouldn't be. I don't think it's.
And the roots will eventually, for most species, will rot in place and they'll take care of themselves.
And I was just looking at all the list of things that you've got going on at the Arboretum, and I know this coming Sunday, there's a Curtis Prairie Walk.
Mm-hmm. We have that would be in our weekly walks. That's every Sunday at 1 o'clock, and the locations can vary, but the Curtis Prairie one, people would just be able to come to the visitor center and join the naturalist then. 1 o'clock on Sunday.
And right at the same time, almost, is another one that's called Fungus Among Us Family Walk.
Uh-huh. The family walks they're wonderful. They're designed for children and parents, of course. And that one, this fall is a terrific time for finding fungi. So that is the time when the naturalists will go out and they'll discover what they can. Hopefully we get a little bit of rain just before so that we get some new fungi growing up. And that also brings to mind, we have a new citizen science project now where we're actually documenting the fungi of the Arboretum. And this is just a terrific combination of collection, but also some genetic work to look at the fungi, and it's going to be an exciting thing to talk about in the future here.
And all that's up on the website there. Your
yes.
website again is
arboretum.wisc.edu.
Arboretum.wisc.edu. Susan, it's always a pleasure.
So much fun. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Susan Carpenter is the Senior Outreach Specialist in the Wisconsin Native Plant Garden at the UW-Madison Arboretum. Next week, Liz Freemuth from the Garden Ho will be back to take your gardening questions. That's at 11 on Friday, 6 a.m. on Saturday, and, of course, online at any time. On Monday, we'll get a tech update with Jesse LeGrew. And then at 11:45, Wisconsin Public Radio Director Mike Crane joins us for his Mondays with Mike conversation. So hope you can join us for that. In the meantime, thanks a lot for listening. Plant some native plants. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.